April's the time when many high school seniors in Illinois are making their decisions regarding where they will go for college. If they choose to go out of state, will they end up making their way back?
If I can't find a job elsewhere, I might end up back there, but I really am looking at either staying in New York or moving to Los Angeles.
That's one college student who left Illinois. We'll also speak with two high school guidance counselors from Springfield and Urbana. Plus, earlier this week, President Trump signed a bill that allows internet service providers to sell users' internet history to advertisers. In Illinois, lawmakers are considering making their own rules, including a bill that would let consumers find out what tech companies do with their personal information. We'll talk with a few online privacy experts to learn more. And a new study from the University of Illinois shows that having crop insurance might have unintended consequences for water use. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's that time of year when many high school seniors are making their college decisions. And we know that more people are moving out of Illinois than moving in. And it turns out that's also true for students who are making decisions about college. In fact, according to a recent New York Times story, it highlighted rising tuition costs and decreasing financial aid as a reason for why more than 16,000 residents left Illinois to attend college in other states. According to that story, Illinois is among the greatest share of high school seniors leaving their home state for college. That was from 2016 numbers, by the way. We'll tweet out the link for you to read the story, which inspired us to talk about this issue today on the 21st. Follow 21ST Show for that. Yesterday, we reached out to one Illinois resident who chose to leave Illinois for college. Hannah Waldron is originally from Elgin. She's now a junior at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, where she's studying forensic psychology. I asked her what factors she weighed back when she was deciding on college.
I looked at UIC, and at the time, I wanted to be a film major, so I was looking at Columbia College. But it ended up being way too expensive.
Oh, it was too expensive. So how much of your decision was about cost?
Probably like 60%.
And did you find then that it just wasn't cost effective to stay in Illinois?
Yeah.
We also asked Hannah if she plans on eventually moving back to Illinois after college.
If I can't find a job elsewhere, I might end up back there, but I really am looking at either staying in New York or moving to Los Angeles.
And of course, that's exactly what we don't want, our youngest and brightest residents leaving Illinois permanently. What do you think? Parents, others, you can join the conversation by tweeting. Our handle's 21STShow. You can give us a call. That number's 1-800-222-9455. Again, 1-800-222-9455. To learn more about how high school seniors today are making their decisions, I'm joined now in studio by Lisa Maselli. She's worked as a director of college counseling at University Laboratory High School in Urbana for the past 24 years. Lisa, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. I'm excited to sit here with you face to face.
Yeah. So have you noticed any differences in recent years, Lisa, regarding where students say they want to go to college?
Sure. What I'm noticing at Uni High, because we have a very great population, kids that we cherry pick to come there, and they've got talent and interest that lots of colleges would look at. They're actually becoming more open to even looking at leaving Illinois because of the merit aid. Who's going to recruit them for how hard that they've worked? And I think sometimes in the state of Illinois, they don't necessarily feel recruited. They don't necessarily feel like Illinois is trying to make Illinois their top choice. Some students might feel that way, but I think because they've worked hard and sometimes their college outcomes validate that hard work for them, they want to feel like somebody is wanting them to come and potentially rewarding them for GPA test scores, talents, and interests.
And so that's a literal financial aid package. That's what you mean by being courted? Or is it also just the reaching out, coming to having different colleges come and recruit on campus at Uni High, which, for those of you who do not know, is literally on the campus of the University of Illinois, for those of you outside the Urbana-Champaign region?
Sure. I think it's probably less of the one-on-one, because actually being downstate, I think the admissions reps have a hard time with their budgets actually traveling to Champaign-Urbana a lot. So we are definitely not in a traffic zone like they would have college reps visiting in Chicagoland. I think it's more of the some colleges will have students call them and talk to them about, what are you looking for in a college? How does our college fit you? Some admissions programs will feel like they're reaching out to them more and asking them to come based on interests and majors. I do think the University of Illinois has done better in that realm. We've seen them offering students while they're applying football tickets to come and kind of experience the culture of a large school. But I think in general, most of our students, even though I may work in an environment that may have some privilege regarding resources, because not every one of our families sits down and says cost is going to be the main decision, no one wants to pay full cost. Everyone wants to have some money towards college. And I think that they're realizing that there are other schools, even out-of-state publics, who are going to possibly entice them with less tuition than they might pay if they stay in state.
So, Lisa, you did something really interesting. You reached out on your Facebook page and you asked your alums why they left Illinois for college.
Sure.
You got so many responses you were showing me before the show. What did some of Uni High alums say about why they left Illinois?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I could summarize this in themes for you, a lot of it was independence. A lot of it was, quote, getting far away from my parents.
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty typical for most high school seniors, right?
But I do think a lot of them often even said, I was at uni 5 years. I played on campus. I walked around Green Street. I want something different.
Yeah.
So some of them truly just talked about, I wanted a different culture. I wanted the ocean.
That's why I came to the Midwest.
Yes.
Because I was in Miami and I thought, I want to see the rest of America. So that's why I ended up in Michigan
exactly.
And then Illinois, because I wanted something as far away from Florida as possible.
Right.
So that's kind of a traditional reason,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Do you hear anyone talking about the budget situation, the ongoing budget impasse, people being concerned? As you know, you have lots of students who parents work at the University of Illinois. If they enroll at the U of I, their tuition is half off. Are you hearing parents being worried about that going away?
Yes, absolutely.
So the budget impasse is playing a role in current high school seniors' decisions?
Yes, especially if it is the half tuition waiver. No one feels a guarantee of that for 4 years. No one knows if they can count on that. Several alums that actually chose to stay at Illinois or chose to leave often said it was because of the half tuition and they hope that it stays and isn't pulled from them. Or one alum said, I was done with the state of Illinois politics and budget, and I was ready to go elsewhere.
And so someone actually said that?
Yes. Two students actually said that was one of the reasons, and I think it was a family conversation. Because we often have parents who say they might move. Once the student graduates from a high school in Illinois, they may also pick up and start a new career.
Right. And I had a couple conversations with folks about that on Facebook, because I put this out on my Facebook page and heard from people saying, we're encouraging our kids to pick out-of-state schools because we're ready to leave as soon as they're finished high school, because we're sick of the political climate. We're worried about our taxes going up. So it's interesting to see how that's trickling down. I'm speaking with Lisa Missel. She's a director of college counseling at Uni High, University Laboratory High School in Urbana. I wanted to bring one more person in this conversation with Lisa Maselli. Brad Kies works to help Springfield High School students figure out their college decisions. Hey, Brad, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Brad, as you're listening to Lisa talk, I wonder what percentage of students at Springfield High School stayed in state and how many went out of state last year?
Sure. So last year we had 56%, which was 81 kids, stayed in state. And then we had 76 or 53% that chose to enroll in a college that was out of state. So very close to 50-50 of our senior class stayed in state and the other half decided to leave.
Are those numbers going up? Do you have a sense? You've been a counselor there for a couple of years. What do you hear from people at Springfield High about how that's changed in the past, say, 5 to 10 years?
Sure. A lot of the kids, in the last 5 years, we're having more that are leaving the state. And I think the reason is just due to scholarship money and financial reasons. A lot of our students are getting more money from out-of-state schools. Our biggest draw in the Springfield area is SEMO, which is Southeast Missouri State University. A lot of kids are leaving there because they are cheaper than most of our state colleges here. If they just get a low score in their ACT of a 22, 23, they get in-state tuition, which knocks that total bill down to cheaper than going to Edwardsville. So a lot of our kids are leaving for financial reasons because they can afford to go somewhere else cheaper with probably the same quality of education.
And Lisa, so it sounds like exactly what you're saying is also happening here in Urbana.
Sure. I've been visiting some of my students who are on a full ride at the University of Houston. They are on a full ride at Ball State. They're on a full ride at Ohio State. They're on a full ride in Iowa. So how do you turn that down? knowing that you can still go to a public university, but if you leave the state is going to say, we're going to celebrate the fact we're recruiting you and we're bringing you in, because every college is trying to diversify their student population.
Yeah, and actually, you know, according to that original New York Times story that inspired our conversation, they sifted through all of this data from the Department of Education. Illinois does actually send the most college students to Missouri. Last year, 2,319 leaving to go to school in Missouri. And of course, as expected, Indiana, Iowa, Wisconsin. Also, that makes a lot of sense. Students going to those places too. Brad, Lisa was talking about, and we were talking about the budget situation, the ongoing budget impasse in Illinois, how that's affected the state universities, our public schools in the past 2 years. Are your students in Springfield, I think, probably particularly attuned to that? I would imagine most of their families perhaps work in some sort of government capacity or related to that. How much of that conversation are you hearing?
Too much of that conversation is being had right now. A lot of the kids and families are worried about the financing, about the politics here. So a lot have decided to go somewhere else. They think the opportunity is going to be greater at a different state. And so we're seeing more students leave. And I also heard in a conversation that, and we're having the same thing here, a lot of the parents said once their kids have graduated and moved on to college, they are planning to either follow their son or daughter, or they themselves are going to leave the state of Illinois and seek residency somewhere else. So those conversations are happening down here as well. But it's scary to think that that's what's happening, that we are, you know, driving away some of our students that would have great opportunities here, would be great citizens here in our state, but they're just leaving now.
It's Brad Kies at Springfield High School. Lisa, he's on the line with us from Springfield. Here in Urbana, Lisa Maselli's in studio with me. Lisa, I know you're planning on attending Illinois Day at the State House in the Capitol on May 10th. That's where alumni and University of Illinois leaders are going to be speaking to legislators about the budget impasse and funding cuts. What message are you going to be sending? What are you going to be saying there?
Well, I'd like to talk with my colleagues from our associations that are going to be traveling in the consortium. I'm 24 years into this profession, and I'm going to now start being more active on this level. But I think because I can wear the hat of an alum from the University of Illinois, I can wear the hat of a counselor who's counseling kids in the state of Illinois and share with them why they're leaving, and also just higher ed in general. I think even I'm worried about community colleges. We've seen Parkland have to reduce their merit aid for students. So I think as we start seeing that, how can we retain our, I mean, there are places where there's scholarships if you're a Georgia resident that try to keep you in state. Or internationally now, we have kids looking overseas. Do they want to study in the UK? Do they want to go to Ireland? Do they want to go to Germany? Because the cost of education is becoming most, I am having broader conversations about what should keep them here, which I'm finding a little disturbing. And I think people need to know those are the conversations we're having, because we'd love to keep the best and the brightest here and then work and pay taxes and give back to our state. We don't want to lose them.
So let me end by asking both of you, what do you say to convince people to stay here? What do you say, Lisa?
Well, anyone who helps students think about their future, we all know it's about the personal fit. And I have to say, to not paint the broad paintbrush stroke as if there's such a crisis in Illinois that kids leave. Kids will often leave, let's use U of I as an example, because they don't want the 100-level large survey courses. They want the small, intimate, small classes. So I think when it comes down to it, my counseling with families when it makes their final choice will never be necessarily trying to keep them here. But if they have a fear that something in Illinois isn't fitting them and you can help them realize, well, let's challenge that and see if it can, especially if it's something that they're overlooking, we'll always challenge kids on making sure they think about their criteria. But I think what often makes our students at Uni High maybe even get into the University of Illinois and discount it may not be that it's necessarily the most expensive school, although for some it has been. It's been cheaper to go private. Private schools have endowment money. I think sometimes they fear being lost in a big sea of students. And would they like a school that's more medium size or a small size? Or they think about going to a small liberal arts college where they're going to have full professors teaching them.
And I guess in the case of Uni High, most students are really only looking at the University of Illinois. They're not really looking at other schools in Illinois.
Actually, no, because of the half tuition waiver, if their parents work, that goes to all 12 public state schools. We have students that are
looking at maybe UIC or other schools.
Actually, Illinois State University is big. Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville and Carbondale, especially dependent on their major, and Northern Illinois. I would probably say those are our four biggest.
Mm-hmm. Brad, what about you? For students who stay in state, what's their reasoning? What are they telling you, and what are you telling them?
Sure. A lot of the kids, I mean, number one reason is they want to stay close to family. That being 18, they don't feel like they are 100% ready to, you know, move out of state, go 4, 5, 6, 10 hours away, and, you know, and have that experience where they're worried, you know, worried about family situations. So a lot of kids are staying. Number one reason is family. Number two reason is just the cost, especially staying at like a community college to start. A lot of kids feel like it helps them save money, helps family save money early on by
doing their first 2 years at a community college.
First 2 years, yeah.
And Lisa, do you say that happens for you as well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I would probably say 15 years ago, we very rarely had a student even consider Parkland. Parkland is now on our students' radar, the Parkland Pathways Program. How can you beat sitting in a University of Illinois course for your first year or two and paying the Parkland rate? So lots of parents are saying, and we're echoing that, it's not where you start, it's where you finish.
Can you explain the Parkland Pathways program?
Yes, Parkland Pathways is an agreement between Parkland and U of I for a certain amount of majors that are on their website that are in this partnership. And if you start at Parkland, you are also a joint student at the University of Illinois with two IDs, all the benefits of being a University of Illinois student. You can live on campus, but you're in the probably 75% of your classes, you're at Parkland for your first 2 years.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, as families are thinking about this, you've given a lot for everybody else to think about this issue of students staying here in Illinois. I want to thank Brad Kies from Springfield High School. I want to also thank Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University Laboratory High School in Urbana. Lisa, Brad, thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla. I appreciate
it. Thanks so much.
Stay tuned to the 21st. Coming up, we're going to be talking about online privacy laws. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 2 days ago, President Trump signed a bill that scraps federal regulations on internet privacy. Internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon no longer will need your permission to mine your internet history for advertising purposes. But state officials are starting to make their own rules. In Illinois, lawmakers are considering what are called right-to-know laws. So even though it won't change the fact that your information is being sold, you'll have a chance to find out what companies are doing with your personal information. We're going to hear from both sides of this now. Joining us online from Chicago to talk about this is Matt Erickson. He's the Industry Outreach Director at the Digital Privacy Alliance. That's a nonprofit that advocates for privacy laws in Illinois. And on the line from Washington, D.C., Carl Sabo is a senior policy counsel with NetChoice. That's a trade association of e-commerce businesses. Carl, Matt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Carl, let's start with you. Yesterday, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart published an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune supporting this right-to-know law. He drew this analogy. He said, imagine you're shopping at your favorite store, and if you go to the checkout, the cashier says before you can pay, they're going to need your name, your address, and your occupation. And then the cashier takes that information into a back room and closes the door where your favorite store puts your information up for sale to the highest bidder, and you're never going to know the identity of who buys it. And he says this is essentially what happens online every day. Do you think that's an accurate analogy?
Thanks for the question. Unfortunately, I think that analogy doesn't quite fit because the way that this bill is written, it is so broad that Metropolis Coffee Shop in Chicago, for example, if I were to just give my email address to subscribe to a newsletter, would be captured by this bill. But I think, you know, as we go forward, it's important to level set and recognize the origin of this bill and where it came from. It was talked about in the New York Times that this bill was created by what are called plaintiff's attorneys. These are private attorneys looking for a big payday, and they make their living by attacking good businesses, and they were the ones who helped write this bill. It's the same type of people who sit on the board of Matt's organization and help to fund its origin. To give you an example of what they're kind of looking for, one of these law firms, Edelson, most recently had a huge settlement with Shutterfly over the ability to provide users search features on photographs that they upload of their own private photo albums, so that I, for example, could find all the photographs that I uploaded that included my wife and son, something that we all use. But Edelson was able to use kind of a antiquated law to pounce and settle with Shutterfly for millions of dollars. And that's the concern that I see coming out of HB 2774.
It's overly
broad.
So, yeah, so for your perspective, Carl, you see that this being broad. Matt, maybe you can give us a sense of why you think SB 1502, right to know. By the way, we should just say the status of that. It's being amended on the Senate floor. The House bill has added many sponsors, is also on the House floor. These are both state bills. Matt, what's your sense of why you think this is important?
Well, first I'd like to address a couple points. A, I am actually in and from the tech industry. I do not represent the plaintiff's attorneys myself. I build software for a living. And common use cases, for example, if I'm a coffee shop and I collect an email address and use a third-party service to manage that, that's okay and exempted in the bill. This bill only covers sharing of data outside of providing business services to customers.
And so what does that mean? What does that mean outside of providing business services? For people who are kind of new to this, how would you explain that to them?
Okay, so for example, there's a popular service called MailChimp. It's used to run newsletters. It's used to send emails to customers and you sign up for a mailing list. And it is a powerful tool, and sending an email address is exempted. And the thing is with this bill, we're not looking to prohibit any of this. All we're looking to do is support this bill, pushed by Tom Dart, and just add transparency to the interaction of letting people see your personal data in exchange for services.
Mm-hmm. So if this law were to get passed, Matt, and I wanted to know with what Google does with my information, what could I do that I can't already do now?
So all that this bill gives you is the ability to ask Google once every 12 months what categories of information they share and what third parties they share it with that isn't in the course of providing you services.
So,
who are they selling it to?
And Carl, what's the opposition that NetChoice has to that? Can you explain why that's a problem for companies to share that?
Yeah, happy to. First of all, I think it's worth going back and actually reviewing the bill, because it applies to any business that collects customer information, like the coffee shop, even if it doesn't share with third parties. So that's in the bill as written. I just wanted to clarify that. So the industry, by the way, we wildly support transparency. We do. It actually is the best way to keep our users informed and to make sure that when they see something that they're not surprised by it. But what we found through many hours of usability testing is that long-form notices, people just don't read. People don't necessarily click on a privacy policy or terms of service and read through it. I used to write them, so I, of course, have read them, but most people don't. And what we found much more effective is just-in-time notice. This bill, unfortunately, ignores this advance in notification for consumers and just adds more legal burdens on small businesses. And
so before we get to Carl, let me stop you for a second, because before we get to the small businesses and the legal burden, can you explain what just-in-time notices are and how different that is from terms of service? Because I think lots of folks are familiar with the big terms of service that you can always agree on if you scroll through and then click yes. What do you mean by just-in-time?
So just-in-time notice is something that we're really integrating into a lot of our sites and services. The most obvious case would be when you install a new application on your phone. Let's say I install Waze, which is a maps feature, which can give me directions from Springfield to Chicago. When I install it and I first open it, I get a pop-up notice that says, this application would like to access geolocation. Would you like to grant that? And right then and there, I'm actually able to see when the call is being made for that information, by whom it's being made, and then I get to give kind of an opt-in, opt-out consent right there. So these types of just-in-time notice have been incredibly helpful. Other forms include as the application or service is using information to periodically remind users that that type of information is occurring, or if right before I send a post or a tweet or something like that, it gives you a notification to whom it will be shared.
Sure, but Carl, that sounds different than what Matt's saying, right? Because Matt's saying we want to know who's getting that information. Isn't it, Matt? That's part of what your law is looking at, right?
And that's and I understand a lot of businesses do make their money off of aggregation and sale of personal customer information. That's the trade-off when you use services for free. They need to make a revenue somehow. And in this case, we're simply asking for transparency in where that data is sold to.
And Matt, yeah, what's your response to what Carl's saying about how much this would be harder for small internet businesses, that this would put an additional compliance cost, regulatory burden on small businesses that maybe couldn't afford to do this?
So a couple points. As an executive at a small internet business, I don't think that this is a huge regulatory burden at all. I would be the guy in charge of the technical implementation side. It's not a big deal. And second off, recent amendments to the bill this week exempt not-for-profits and they exempt companies of 5 or less employees, thus making sure we protect Illinois small business.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask both of you, Carl, I know that these laws, a lot of laws like this already exist in Europe. You know, there are right-to-know laws that exist. Do you feel like, Matt, would it make sense for people to think of this as similar to laws that already exist in Europe?
Sorry, Carl.
Yeah, this is to Matt. And Carl, I'm going to follow up with you in a second. Go ahead, Matt, first, though.
All right. Sorry about that. I think, honestly, the European regulations are pretty decent. One of the competing tech sectors geographically is in Germany, and they have some of the strictest privacy laws in the world. I don't believe that we'd be facing, if additional regulation for protecting people's basic rights to their data was as harmful as the industry makes it out to be, I don't believe we'd be facing nearly as much competition from Europe in new startups, small business, et cetera.
Carl, what's your response to that in terms of looking at the European model?
I mean, just looking at innovation in and of itself, I hope like heck we don't end up like Europe. One of Europe's crown jewels, which was Spotify, actually had to leave Europe because the privacy regulations there are so draconian and so oppressive that it forestalls innovation. If you actually stop and think, how many great tech startup businesses have come out of Europe versus the United States? It's not even a comparison. And that's because Europe's regime is so much leaning towards a mother may I permissive system as opposed to the American model, which allows innovation, development, and testing. So some people may say we should go and be more like Europe, but if we do that, then we lose one of the greatest sectors in the United States today, and that's our tech sector, and that's our innovation sector.
Matt, from someone who's in the tech industry, as you've said a couple times, how much do you think this push for these right-to-know laws in Illinois, we're seeing this happen in other states, specifically has to do as it specifically is a reaction to the Trump administration and to congressional approval of these changes to privacy last week?
Well, Illinois legislature has been working on this before the Trump privacy rulings. We have America's strongest biometric privacy laws. And we're in some cases, for example, trying to play catch up with California's privacy laws, just trying to match Silicon Valley for regulation. And the Trump ruling only really hammered home that we're being let down by our representatives in Washington and it's time for the states to step up and fill in where the federal government is clearly unwilling to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for that. I want to thank Matt Erickson, who's the Industry Outreach Director with the Digital Privacy Alliance, joining us from Chicago. In Washington, Carl Sabo, Senior Policy Counsel with NetChoice. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to bring someone else in this conversation, Russell Brandom. He's a reporter with The Verge who's been listening in to us discuss all of these privacy issues. Hey, Russell, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks. So that was sort of like we were hearing kind of from both sides of that there, right? From someone who's in the tech industry who is pushing for these laws, and then someone who represents other parts of the tech industry who are don't want this. And I wonder what stood out to you in that conversation.
I mean, I think it's a very important conversation to have. I think in general, people don't realize how far a piece of data that a company has, how far that can go, right?
And I think can you give us an example?
I think, the fact that you make a purchase with a credit card, maybe it's a store-based credit card, and then, the fact that you bought a particular size of shirt is something that then, obviously if I bought it from Target knows that I wear an extra small t-shirt. It would never have occurred to me that anyone else would want to know, but this is in fact, this is then useful for advertisers to know, and also something that ends up, political campaigns will say, well, let's just make sure we have everyone's shirt size, all the data that we can get on, to correlate with voting records. And very quickly, anyone who's trying to reach you has a huge amount of data that they can draw from. There's really no force preventing it from spreading because it's a lucrative thing to share if there are no regulations about it.
Well, just to use the Target example, I remember a couple of years ago, this uproar when everyone realized Target was so good at mining data, it actually knew women were pregnant before, in some cases, the rest of their family did, based on the purchases that they were making in their first trimester. And then they started sending coupons. I know there was a situation where one family actually found out that I think it was a daughter was pregnant based on all of the formulas and coupons they were sending. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I would point to just this week, there was the Massachusetts Attorney General ended up having a fine against a company that was geofencing ads around abortion clinics so that women who went to the abortion clinic, if they were on their phones, would see certain ads that were, I'm sure you've seen billboards on the highway to this effect, but it was, we know that you're within this particular, 100 foot or 200 foot radius.
So they were sending that to women's phones who were coming near abortion clinics.
Well, and really any phones that were in that vicinity, but it was specifically saying, choose life and that sort of thing. And ultimately, the settlements, the Massachusetts Attorney General said, this is a violation of privacy to target this specifically, right? I think it's very tricky. I think, the thing that we've been covering is the recent ISP rules that you alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
That,
hey, Russell, can you hold on a second? Because we're going to have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to continue that conversation. And let's go into those ISP rules. Let's talk about that a little bit more. Explain the law recently passed by Congress, just signed by President Trump, scrapping restrictions on what companies can do with personal data. And then we're also going to, you're going to give us some tips for people to understand a little bit more about how to protect their privacy online. So stay tuned. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with this conversation with Russell Brandom from The Verge. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We're tweeting out different context to what we're talking about, different articles. Right now, we're discussing internet privacy, online privacy with Russell Brandom. He's a reporter from The Verge. We've been talking about both the right to know law that's being discussed here in Illinois in the State House, as well as federal regulations, a law earlier this week signed by President Trump that scraps federal restrictions on what companies can do with your personal data. Russell, just before the break, you were going to go into that. Can you explain a little bit more about that law for folks who have maybe have just seen the headlines and don't understand the details?
Yeah, so it's tricky. Essentially, to zoom out all the way, the FCC is in charge of kind of interpreting these old telecom laws. And in this particular one, it was a 1996 provision on what data providers can share. And because since Title II, that law now applies to internet companies, the question was, okay, what can they do with consumer network information, which includes, because the ISP is your gateway to the internet, they can see which domains you're visiting and which websites you're reading, in some cases, which specific sort of articles and sort of sites you're going to.
When I go shopping, this is why I always go into private mode, so I don't see the ads for things that I'm shopping for later on. Essentially, that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, so this is what's interesting. Private mode will help keep you logged out of Google and Facebook and a lot of sort of storage like that. And so it'll help against those. But if you go into private mode, your ISP can still see what you're looking at.
Right.
So, and this is why this is particularly high stakes for privacy folks, because it's much harder to evade that kind of tracking. If you don't want to be tracked by Facebook, you can just sign out of Facebook, delete your account, and then they won't know anything about you. Whereas, a lot of people only have one option for connecting to the internet.
Right. It's Comcast, Verizon, whoever. Sure.
Exactly. So essentially, under Obama, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler had put in some fairly strong interpretations of what the law meant for restrictions on these companies. And basically, this is Congress acting to undo what Wheeler had put in place. So now we kind of don't know what the rules are. The current FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, has a much more free market, hands-off approach to regulation. So the assumption is that it will be much less restrictive. And in fact, he may just sort of let the market decide for a while and not have any specific regulations. But yeah, it's essentially there are many fewer restrictions on companies like Verizon and Comcast than there were a week ago.
So Russell, I'm sure there are people who are listening who are kind of freaking out right now and thinking, what can I do to protect my privacy? What advice do you have for actionable steps that everyone can take if they're interested in doing that?
Yeah, so I would say the first thing is look at the settings and the preferences that you have with your carrier, right? I think a lot of people aren't aware that these pages even exist. They never go to them. But if you go to the Verizon website, that's sort of the same website where you pay your internet bill, it will have various preferences and settings where you can opt in or out of certain information collection things. And really, very few people go to those, but if you want to keep an eye on what data is being collected and shared about you, that is a great first stop. Mm-hmm. And I think, we don't know what programs are going to be put in place as a result of this because it's all so recent, but the assumption is legally that there has always been an opt-out. The question has always been, well, do they have to opt in or do you have to opt out?
Mm-hmm.
It seems
right.
Like now you'll probably have to opt out, and most people won't opt out because most people won't go to the preferences page. But if you're concerned about it, go to the preferences page and sort of keep going because new things may appear there. But you should be able to opt out of anything once that's there. And if they don't put that in there, there are various legal problems that they can get into. And so probably there will be something there.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is, a lot of what we're seeing comes down to people not trusting these big internet service providers to act in a way that respects their privacy, right? And that's maybe some listeners do trust those companies, but a lot of people that I talk to don't. And I would say a great opportunity for that is there are municipal broadband projects. There's actually a bunch in Illinois. I know Rock Falls in the West is working on it. They tend to be in smaller towns where the service isn't otherwise is great, but we've seen some sort of mesh network things pop up in larger cities too. I would say investigating that is a great way to get out of your dependence on these larger companies overall. And there are a lot of really exciting things happening there. Now that might mean you have to start your own. It might mean you have to kind of go a little bit out of your way to reset your service. But if you're really concerned and you don't trust the service providers that are available to you, that's a great alternative to look into.
So do you trust this internet service providers as someone who covers them? What's your sense of this?
Well, I am speaking to you over a Verizon Fios connection.
Right, you're on a Google via Google Voice, right?
So. Yeah, exactly. So I clearly trust them to a certain extent. I think, I mean, I'll say one of the scenarios that's popped up in the wake of this is the idea that someone will sell your individual web history, right? This is, and we've seen campaigns to buy like congressman's web history as sort of retaliation for this. And I don't think that's something we're going to see. I think that
it's all aggregated data is what we're thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think once you move outside of, you know, the legal term is individualized. And I think it's, I don't want to trust those terms too much. Like, I think there is a real privacy concern in having all of this information available just within Verizon for Verizon employees to look at, or possibly there's a compromise and this sensitive data is exposed to other people. And, or you know, if some Russian secret agent wants to see my web history and they break into the Verizon data store. I mean, I think just having this information around is a privacy concern, but I also think while it's important to vigorously defend your privacy on political grounds, it's also, I don't want to overstate the threat to individuals in terms of like your personal information being revealed by this.
I do think you're trying to be more invasive, more reasonable about it, right? It sounds like, right?
What was that?
I said it's just sort of more just sort of rational about the fact that how likely is it that individual data will be, and how possible is it even to get all of this individual data on a personal basis?
Yeah, I think companies have a strong interest in not letting that happen, right? I think it all exists within the company. But again, if the company shares it, they open themselves up to lawsuits on a number of other grounds. And also, I mean, I think even with the less restrictive FCC regulations, there are still rules against sharing personally identifiable data that I think would be important there in terms of individuals. Yeah.
That's Russell Brandom. He's a reporter with The Verge. For those of you who are curious about this, we're going to tweet out a couple more links on this, a little bit more about what Russell was talking about. They'll all be collated, of course, at our website at 21stshow.org. Russell, thanks so much for being with me.
Mm-hmm. Happy to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Before we end for the hour today, one more thing we wanted to talk about. You know, farmers have to pay a lot of money up front just to start growing their crops. And obviously, often the biggest unknown is how much money they're actually going to earn from selling them. That's why many farmers have crop insurance. But a new study out from the University of Illinois shows that having crop insurance may have unintended consequences for water use. Megan Konar is one of the co-authors of this study. She's an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois and joins us on the line now. Megan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So your study looked at the relationship between crop insurance and water use. Why would this matter?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And so as you mentioned, I mean, so crop insurance, the goal of it is really to protect farmer income from fluctuations due to extreme weather, crop pests and disease. It's become really an increasingly important part, a really large part of our global food system, our food system. And so we were interested really in what is the impact on water use. And the reason this is interesting, or it could have an impact, is because crop insurance has been shown to change farmer production decisions. And water is also another really large part of the food system. So we were curious about what the link is between crop insurance and water, and we wanted to determine if there are any unintended consequences of crop insurance for water resources.
Sure. What did you find?
So our main goal, our main question was, does crop insurance strain water resources or help us to use them more sustainably? And we found that crop insurance does lead us to withdraw more water resources for irrigation. So it does place more strain.
Interesting. So based on your research, do you have a sense of why or how a farmer having crop insurance would lead them to use more water than they would if they didn't have crop insurance?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we tried to really figure out why it is the case. And so one aspect we were able to quantify was that it does lead farmers to grow different crops. So in particular, we found that farmers started growing more cotton, and in particular, they started growing more groundwater-fed cotton. So they used more water basically as a consequence of growing a more water-intensive crop. So we showed that quantitatively in our study. And anecdotally, we've heard just stories that farmers sometimes are watering their crop, even though it's clear that it's failed, because there are stipulations in their insurance contracts that in order to receive a payout, they have to prove that they've irrigated a normal amount of water.
Okay, so that makes sense. So not just trying to fulfill the terms of their insurance, but also makes sense they're willing to take higher risks because they know they have the insurance to back it up as well.
That's right.
So how do the findings in your study apply to Illinois specifically? Are we seeing more cotton grown here, for example?
Yeah, well, so this was a national study, so we don't focus specifically on Illinois in our work, but it does have implications for Illinois. Illinois is an interesting example because currently we don't have a lot of irrigation in the state. Most of our agriculture is rain-fed, which means it's grown with just rainfall, not irrigation water supplies. But in the future, we think that we're going to need more irrigation in the state as the rainfall patterns become more variable and there's longer durations between rain events. So it's likely that there's going to be increased demand for irrigation in the state. And so we just wanted to point out that this interaction between crop insurance and irrigation is one that we might want to consider moving forward.
And how does climate change, what role does that play in all of this as well?
Yeah, well, that's really the reason why we project rainfall patterns are going to become more variable as the climate warms. There's projections that the hydrologic cycle will be intensified, and so rainfall patterns will become more intense but less frequent. So that is really the main role that climate change, or one of the main roles that climate change will play in the system.
And what do you have a sense of the results of this research? What implications do you think there are for policymakers in terms of maybe how they should be looking at, maybe even if crop insurance should be structured differently?
Yeah, well, I guess our main agenda was to improve understanding. So we just wanted to really understand what the impact was, of crop insurance for water resources. And now that we have the understanding, we hope that, you know, we can equip policymakers with the understanding and then they can use that as one item that they consider going forward.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That's Megan Konar. She's an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois, one of the co-authors of this new study. We'll tweet out all the links to that for those of you who are interested in learning a little bit more about it. You can read the study yourself. Follow us at 21ST Show. We'll also throw it up at our website at 21stshow.org. Megan, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, by the way, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. As I mentioned, all of that's at our website, 21stshow.org. I mentioned our Twitter handle a couple times this hour. That's because if you search for 21ST Show, we live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. In fact, if you want to see that Institute for Government and Public Policy Affairs report from the University of Illinois, you can see all of that online. We tweeted it as well. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montecilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.